coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special pre-episode of The Curious Realm. I am so very excited for our episode tonight. We have some great guests. In the second part, we will be hearing from Kathleen Ball about the Knights Templar and some of her new research regarding a Knights Templar cave that she found in Brazil. In the first part of our show, we are very, very pleased to welcome Tyler Roberts. He is the host of Total Disclosure. He's involved with the International UFO Bureau, who we have had on before, and recently had a NASA whistleblower, Dr. Gregory Rogers, on his show. Here's a small clip of that with
this
Mr. Rogers.
This guy stops me, and, you know, at the time, my first inclination was, I don't want to bother with whatever the guy's doing, but he was kind of insistent and said, it'll just take a few minutes. I've got to show you this thing. So I foolishly went inside with him, and he locked the door, closed the louvers. As soon as he did that, I said, why are you doing that? He said, well, we need to do this. And,
no, I don't want to give all that away. Welcome back, or welcome to our show, Tyler Roberts. How are you doing, my friend? It's been great catching back up with you today, all kinds of stuff. Congratulations on the big whistleblower drop. That was absolutely fantastic. You've been getting some great views on that. And what a proud moment for IUFOB coming out of the gate with that. Before we get into the interview, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into the world of podcasting to begin with? How did you come to the world of UFO and UFO research?
Yeah, well, it's, and thank you. Thank you so much. That was a great introduction and a great great clip to put up there to tease it a little bit. That amazing conversation, and you know, I'm so thankful to the Bureau, to the International UFO Bureau, to Dr. Gregory Rogers for having the bravery to step forward.
Yeah.
I think in this community, you know, it can be hard for people to come forward because, you know, there is that added layer of stigma and ridicule that you will face. Like, it's not something that's, you know, maybe going to happen. It's, when is it going to happen?
Yeah.
So again, you know, a lot of that respect will have to go to Dr. Rogers. But yeah, how did I start? I think, I mean, for the first time, I remember the first time I saw a movie in the theater. I don't even remember what movie it was, but I remember feeling so much during the film. And, you know, the conditions of a movie theater, you know, dark, right? The big screen, larger than life. And then the feelings it gave me were larger than life and larger than feelings that I've had, you know, out and about as a kid. So when I saw my first movie, I said to myself, I want to do that. I want to make people have emotion and, yeah, and have those feelings. So, you know, I never wanted to be a policeman. I never wanted to be an astronaut, right? I never wanted to be a whistleblower. I never wanted to do any of those things. I always wanted to make movies and be in media. And that's really where it all kicked off, of course. And, you know, I think as artists, as creators, we are the ones that are naturally going to start asking the bigger questions.
Yeah.
You know, obviously a lot of people in the UFO community are, you know, some sort of artist as well, musician, filmmaker, you know, just a writer, right? A journalist, researcher, you know, there's some sort of creativity or some sort of spark there. And, you know, I was always the person at the party who might have not been at the beer pong table, but I was definitely in the corner with my friends talking about whether, you know, the world was going to end in 2012.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was right? Me as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, my mom, you know, she's a big part of my story, in terms of, you know, how I got here and why I stay here. And, you know, she passed away in 2021. Her death date is actually 4/3/2/1.
Oh, wow.
Which is odd in itself.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to it. And, you know, she's a big part of who I am, who I became. You know, she always, because when I was younger, she always had this thing about her where she would, every once in a while, she'd be like, hey, want to stay home from school? And of course, as a kid, you're like, yeah, of course I want to stay home. And then, you know, I'd just be hanging with her. And, it was after 9/11, but before middle school. So, you know,
okay,
I must have been like fifth grade or something like that. And so I'm outside. I remember Regis and Kelly was at 9 a.m. That ended around 10. I'd say a couple hours could have went by, but I was at that time in the day where I was now waiting for the kids to come home, right? I was waiting for them to get off the bus. I was outside of my house, not this house where I am now, but my parents' house, and I was tossing a tennis ball up onto the roof. And the way it would come down off the slope, you could almost like play catch with yourself. And it was cool. You know, it was obviously like a sad thing saying it out loud, but I mean, you know, we didn't have cell phones then.
Yeah, yeah.
And we didn't have all the stuff we have now. And I was mid throw and I'm looking straight up because I'm trying to bring the ball, you know, to the roof. So I'm pitched, like looking up, and a flying saucer comes literally. And when I say flying saucer, I'm talking about your classic disc, classic gunmetal gray with three points on it that, like, you know, maybe three lights. They weren't on because it was broad daylight. So they, you know, they weren't illuminated. But if you drew like a line to each circle, it would make a triangle. So, you know, picture the circle with like three lights that make a triangle if you were to like draw a line to them. And so the craft is oscillating but moving forward. Now, I grew up next to an Air Force base, so I'm pretty familiar with, even by that time, I'm pretty familiar with what flies and what doesn't. And this thing was treetop level. It was not moving fast enough. And I ran inside. I was like, Mom, I don't know what I just saw. And instead of like saying, you know, you saw a balloon, or, you know, you didn't see anything at all, she was like, you saw a UFO, dude. And she told me all about what the U in UFO was.
Wow.
How we didn't know. She didn't force a belief system on me.
Sure.
And never, she wasn't religious. My parents aren't too religious. I mean, I definitely think there was like some like, you know, God figure for them, but it wasn't something they forced on us. And yeah, she brought me to the library the next day because I begged and begged and begged to know more. And that's where the journey started. And that's where movies intersected, right?
All right.
Now I had a mission. I had a topic. But then my destination ended up as Hollywood. So for a long time, I was more on the media side and the like regular sci-fi Hollywood.
Okay.
You know, I got Marvel, DC, that I was always drawn to superheroes. They're larger than life. You know, I maybe envied them a little bit. And
sure.
I would say I was always drawn towards sci-fi, but that's how I got into media. And obviously that's how I got into the subject of UFOs. But I stated, you know, again, I was talking about it at parties with people. I was talking about it with my friends when we were smoking joints, like stuff
sure.
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we ate a lot of mushrooms in high school. Did a lot of experimentation with the things that will definitely enhance your ability to see beyond the veil.
The indigens.
Yes. So, you know, I'm a lot more reserved now, but, you know, I would still, if someone had DMT, like, consider me locked and loaded. I'm coming on the ride.
I'm on the boat.
Yeah.
Like, I did my ayahuasca journey last year.
It's amazing,
I've definitely
right?
DMT'd. It's something totally different. I had an experience years ago with And it's one of those that I bring up on the show mainly because it's one that, you know, when people have shared experience, it's so funny how regularly they do not talk about it. And me and my buddy from high school had a night. It was New Year's Eve, things like that. And we, the few things were involved, but the neighbor was an autistic kid, very high functioning, from our high school. But one that was like savant with numbers, things like that. Right. He was with us that night, just riding his bike as we went to the gas station to pick up more beer. And we saw this huge amorphous black object. It was not, it was an object in the sky, but it wasn't like, like your sighting or like so many where it's like this is a defined shape. It was just this amorphous thing that was probably the size of a couple city buses stacked on top of each other, just moving through the sky of Houston, blocking out stars behind it and things like that.
Houston, we have a problem.
We literally wrote it off to, oh, you know, a few things were involved. When we went back to my buddy's house the next New Year's Eve, Ari, the neighbor, was there, stuck his face up over the fence and was like, hey guys, you think we'll see something in the sky like we did last year?
And you're like, that kid was not,
whoa,
he was sober as a goat.
Yeah. Yeah. And we hadn't really talked about it until just recently. He writes like short form horror and things like that. And just texted me one day and was like, hey man, I just wrote a story about that. About that, like, do you remember that night? Am I crazy? Do you remember that night? And I'm like, absolutely, I remember that night.
Isn't that isn't it, you know how many people I interview where they'll be telling a story, and you've probably had this experience many times as well, but how many times, how often is it, I'd say far too often, that the, when there is a shared experience, it's almost like something in the moment. Of course, you experience it, but then it's when it's over, it's almost just like something turns off and you go back to doing regular life. And you don't talk amongst yourselves about it. Like, dude, what was that? And then it comes up some years later and you're like, wait, you did see that? I thought I was crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's like, how many times is that the case? And you got to ask, is that by design?
Regularly, because yeah.
And it's so weird.
Well, and it's strange sometimes, and one of the cases I bring up with that regularly is Terry Lovelace.
Again, you know, it's funny. As I'm telling that, he's who I'm thinking of.
So yeah, because he's one of those, like, he was an EMT in the Army. That's like riding as a cop. Like, you see things when you're an EMT. And when you're rolling with a partner as an EMT, you really see things. Like, you attend deaths. Things like that. Like, you're trying to save people's lives, that kind of stuff. You've seen some things, much less if you're an EMT in the Army, that kind of stuff. And the fact that their shared experience eventually drove them apart because they didn't talk about it.
Yeah. You know? That's the thing. I think it's almost like, sorry.
It's okay,
brother. I don't know if it's pride or if it's fear of ridicule or, you know, that notion of like self-preservation through like disassociating from it completely. Because if you were to accept that it happened, you might be thinking, I'm crazy.
Yeah.
I must be crazy. Right.
Yep.
So if I admit that it happened, then I am crazy. So it didn't happen. I'm not crazy.
Well, it's easier to reconcile that. It's easier. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. Anybody in the audience viewing on in chat, whatever. Tell me if you aren't just willing to hide something in utter shame and tell nobody, not even tell your significant other, things like that. You know,
I mean, you
it's
know,
a, it's a thing.
And I'll say this because you talked about the EMT thing and being around death and that. All right. So fast forward a couple years, obviously, but I'd been doing the movie podcast and radio and interviews for, I would say, 3 or 4 years by that time. And my mom got sick with cancer. She actually, I remember, it's a very weird synchronicity here. And it's only a synchronicity now that I look back on it, because the day that I started my first podcast, I'm talking recorded my first episode.
Yeah.
I was about to hit record on the camera and I got a call from my brother that my mom had been sick. She had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And then I went into the episode and, you know, looking back on it, I still have the episode and I frequently went back and tried to look at my face and tried to see what was there, because I was there. Of course, I have video evidence I was there.
Yeah, yeah.
I was not there.
Yeah.
I must have checked out. But the show went amazingly, and I fell in love with podcasting and, you know, kind of getting out of the movie realm. And, you know, that was the first time I'd fallen in love with this new art form that was podcasting. And, the co-host that episode, you know, really carried the show. And I think he was able to take me out of it. But I mean, it's very weird looking back on it, because then I was in the middle of an episode and this is some, obviously the day my mom died some years later, where I was doing the episode and I had Owen Gleiberman was on the show, and anyone that you might be familiar with his name, because he's the chief film critic of Variety. And he recently, like now, he just wrote a hit piece basically on that Age of Disclosure, because he was there at the South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And Variety kind of ripped on that film, saying
a little bit.
It's just another. You know, there's no evidence in it. It's just testimony.
Just another milquetoast documentary.
So ironically, someone who I never thought I was going to interact with at all again, that episode, I was recording it with him and it was live. And my sister called me like 7 times in a row. And she never does that. She never, ever, ever did that. And I took the call and, you know, I had to get back to my parents' house. My mom, it was going to be the day. And I was in the room with her when she passed.
Beautiful.
And I looked at her and she was there, you know, she was definitely there, because, you know, we had already talked. I'm kind of fast forwarding just because this is a really drawn out story now. But I'm anyone will know this, when you're looking at a person, you know, their soul is there. Then something happened where I looked down for just a millisecond, maybe. And by the time I came back up, this orb crosses my field of vision and goes out the window, pops up. And I look back and my mother's now gone.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
My hypothesis is either something came and got her, or that was her leaving. I don't know which of... these are my hypothesis, but
sure.
That is the moment I started Total Disclosure. That moment when I saw that orb is when everything from my past, every single moment, my years of alcoholism, my toxic Hollywood, all of it, I just fucking threw it away. I was
beautiful.
Like, no more.
Beautiful, man.
Gone. Gone.
Yeah.
And Total Disclosure was born that minute, because my mom was once again showing me the truth.
Wow. That, and what a beautiful testimony to that, you know. And,
yeah.
And not only to that moment, but to the relationship with your mother, for that catharsis to come through that moment of mission, you know.
Yeah. And the mission was clear.
Yeah.
It was a find out.
Yeah, and it's interesting how moments like that can lead you to those life-changing moments where a totally different decision comes about, much like any paranormal experience. You know, it's one of those, there's something that just changes when you go through that. And it's something that I've mentioned, whether it's paranormal, cryptid,
yeah.
UFO, it's one of those. And the hypothesis I bring up is the idea of being near a craft that would frequency wise change you the same way as a watch is changed by a magnet. You know, it tells time differently from that point on, you know.
And maybe just maybe that, you know, because after those moments, the world is no longer black and white.
That's right.
It is absolutely the furthest thing from that, because now you see, oh shit, there's a lot of gray.
Yeah.
And things change quick. I call it the moment of conversion. It's when you go from, you know, is this real, to holy shit, this is real.
Well, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's plain and simple. And you know, for most people, I would say, if the moment is as dramatic as it usually is, aside from the people that like we talked about, they're like, I'm not even touching this. I'm not talking about it ever again. It never happened. It never, you know, those people do exist. They're mostly religious. sorry, I apologize.
It's okay.
They're organized religious. And that's the thing. That's okay. I understand.
It's hard not to have things or want things in a box. Boxes are nice and pretty. They contain things in a very, very clean way.
Yeah. So, because and my whole thing here is, we have to understand that we, you know, the biggest lie we're told from a very, very young age is that. We look at our parents like they're all knowing, like they have all the answers. Most of the time we have some sort of adult figure that we look at and we're like, well, they know everything. Like, I'm going to get to that point where I know everything just like them. And we look at them like gods, or, you know, cause that would make us heroes or villains. And it makes it all more a little bit fanciful.
Yeah.
It's not until much later we realize that they're just human beings and they're winging it day by day. They have no fucking clue what's going on.
That's right.
Just like the rest of us.
Yeah.
And it's when you come to realize that all of this, right? All of this is, I mean, it's a cosmic blip, right? We are special, but we are also not unique.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So I think it's perspective.
Yeah.
I think it is. Because then you learn to make the most out of what you have right this moment. And you stop focusing on if there is a heaven or hell.
Yeah.
Look, it doesn't matter. I'm going to enjoy right now.
That's right.
That's what I know I have.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that's what mission is all about. You know, the idea of like, what can we do right now so that we can leave a legacy for tomorrow? You know, because that's all you ultimately have control of is how the world views you when you're gone. That's pretty much it, you know. So what have you done to help build community instead of tear it down? What have you done to, you know, help further the world? Things like that.
A big example, you know, and I'll give everyone in the UFO community an example right now.
Sure.
We just lost Earl Grey Anderson.
Yeah.
That guy will be, he will, very, yes. Yeah. He was a mentor of mine. Yeah. And
same,
you know, I never met the guy face to face. Never met the guy face to face, but him and I talked on the phone. Anytime we were on the phone, it was 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Came on the podcast so many times, I can't count. That guy was nothing but positive.
Yep.
He did this for the love of the game.
That's right.
He will go down in history, in ufology history, UFO history, as, you know, a great researcher, a great friend, and someone who will be dearly missed. And do you want to leave that legacy, or do you want to leave a legacy like Jack Sarfati's going to leave? Ask yourself that question.
Yeah. And it's interesting, even whenever you start looking at things, because, you know, there's a lot of shows out there that sensationalize a lot of things, Tyler. Heck, I used to work for a show that's inside. It's one of my dirty secrets that I was once an on-air producer for Alex Jones and InfoWars.
Oh.
Hey.
I'm sorry.
Hey, man.
I'm sorry, buddy.
I've also pushed buttons for PETA events. I've pushed buttons for the Texas Republican Caucus. I push buttons. That's what I do for a living, you know?
Hey, you know what?
I'm a producer. I push buttons.
I wouldn't even have to forgive you because I don't see what you did as something to be sorry about.
Yeah.
It's just to learn.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it's one of those, like, learning the backside of that.
Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
It was all a farce, right?
Well, you know what's funny, man? Like, I was actively there. It was me and him on air that day. I was running the booth. Richard Belzer was our guest, talking about his JFK assassination book. And Alex was on air when the Boston bombing happened. When the Boston Marathon bombing happened.
Yeah, I live in Boston.
And man, I know. And that was one of those that, like, I watched that from the very beginning through the very end. And it was one of those, like, there was some disturbing stuff that happened during that where it's like things that didn't make sense. Like, I actively got the older brother was a boxer, and I got his sparring partner from Florida. His wife on the show, because he was shot in the top of the head by the FBI his dad went on the news with a picture of his son's vivisected body. It was like, the FBI killed my son while they were interrogating him. She left for Chechnya and never came back. I got her on the show.
No.
And she was like, I will never come back to this country. They will kill me and my children. Like,
wow.
Dead serious. So there were things like that that happened where it's like, that's real stuff. That was there. Like, I was involved with that.
But I promise you.
I will also say that a lot of what you see on the show is very much crafted. It is, let's take the news, let's read it and put it through the lens of history. Let's then extrapolate it to the worst case scenario. And when we go to commercial, we're going to sell you a solution for the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
That is the setup and the knockdown of the show. Now, if he just read the news and put it through the lens of history, that would be horrifying enough.
If he just told the truth in an unbiased way. Yeah,
you don't have to extrapolate to the worst case scenario.
And here's the thing about Alex, though. And, you know, we can get off this just after this.
Sure.
You know, the guy is smart.
He is.
People don't give him enough credit.
Oh, his
for how
recall.
Many things he's actually been right about. And it's just, I think he really had a problem. And I'm the biggest forgiver of addiction. Yeah. You know, I have it.
Same.
You know, I wake up every day on uncured, untethered, and I have to make the choice to stay away from a drink or drugs, right? So, you know, for me, I do have sympathy for the alcoholism and just like
absolutely.
The wild amount of money that guy had coming in. But it doesn't excuse you. You have to take ownership for things that you've said.
Yep.
And, you know, there's one that we all know about. I won't say the words.
Yeah.
Never.
Mm-hmm.
But he took one thing too far. And paid the price.
Yeah.
And now he's doubling down on everything because he needs to make up the money that he owes to all these people. And if he's not pushing snake oil now, I mean, if he wasn't pushing snake oil then, I mean, God, is he pushing it now?
Because that's the dangerous part, you know, and I've guessed it on shows. And it's one of those, like, I actually had a moment of clarity on this show with Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. Where AI picked it out and posted it for me. It was so funny because I was like, you know, you kind of have to be lukewarm with research.
Yeah.
And it's like, I realize why my show sometimes doesn't have a larger audience. And it's because I actively try to demystify things that are happening in the community instead of furthering the fervor behind them.
Well, why do you think? Now, let me ask you this. We have a huge problem in this community.
We do.
And we have a huge problem.
Yeah.
And there is some, and I don't want to, I hate to even allude to something like this, but there are a set of people in our community that sit atop the throne, if you will. And if you are not actively endorsing, if you are not actively participating in the narrative, the chosen narrative, the controlled narrative, the DOD approved narrative,
yep,
chances are your whistleblowers or your episodes, they'll get seen, you know, by the people that understand all of this, but you will never be reached out by someone like Ross Coulthart.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want to say Jeremy, because they are great people.
They are.
But there are people in this community that are gatekeeping the narrative. Mm. We all know some of them. It's very easy to see. And we need to be careful, because if you're defending your favorite UFO guru, like it's your fantasy football team, you probably have an issue.
Yep. Yep.
Right?
And you know, it gets that way with anything, man. I say it regularly, even whenever it comes to politics. It's like, you know what's funny? Rockstar typically doesn't run the label. The front man of the band is typically not the dude running the label. You know? Yeah. He's the front man for a reason.
Yeah, right. He's a good face.
Yeah, precisely. And it's one of those, you do have to be careful, because if you get caught up in the fervor of things, and the prime example that I give regularly on this show is Corey Good.
Oh my God,
it's easy to go down that rabbit hole. It's so easy, you know.
And that was a cult.
It all verges on it, period. Hey, as a former Catholic seminarian, believe me, I can attest to the heart of the true believer, and the person who is just of faith and trusts. Like, we watched the documentary on, oh my God, the cult just left
Dark
my
Alliance?
Head. No, that was a great
Heaven's
documentary.
Gate.
Yes, Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's
and my
Gate,
wife
yeah.
was like, I don't understand. And I was like, I fully understand. Like,
yeah,
I get that.
I do too.
They were utterly true believers. You know, this was what they believed in their heart of hearts was going to happen
yep.
for them. Like that.
Yep.
I don't mourn
that the
for them.
The Hale-Bopp comet was.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't.
Hey, listen, maybe we were all fucking. You
maybe
know,
we were all wrong.
I was literally just going to say, who knows? Who really does know?
When Marshall Applewhite greets us at the end, Tyler, then we'll all figure it out.
Yeah, the Hale-Bopp comet might have came by. It, you know, all the people that did, you know, do that, commit a tragedy, you know, by living people's standards.
I'm ready.
Because we don't know what happened. I mean, for all we know, they did wake up on the comet and they were like, jokes on all you idiots.
Told you.
Right?
But that's just it. And you know, to bring this first part of the conversation full circle before we move on. That's the hard part. Even whenever you have faith, even whenever you believe in something, that hard part is sharing that true conviction with somebody right. else, because you may be ridiculed for your true faith. You may be ridiculed for what you believe. You know,
absolutely.
You may be cast down for what you believe. And especially when you're talking about whistleblowers, like that's one of the big things. We did a great episode with Earl Grey whenever the Napolitano and Robbins lawsuit went through for the Netflix documentary. Oh no, I think I lost your audio there.
No, you didn't.
Okay.
You weren't supposed to hear that.
Okay, good.
My dog got something and he's currently not supposed to have that something. So
that's
I'm wondering,
okay.
Yeah, but, I'm wondering where.
But yeah, the idea of, what are these things doing to communities? You know, what is possible planted information? Like the things like the photo that Lou Elizondo shared of the chandelier that came from his vetted source. You know,
well,
it's like, is that misinformation being injected into the community to cause these rifts? You
well,
know?
Look at the chandelier picture. I mean, boy, is that just the beginning.
Yeah.
Because, all right, and listen, I to be the one to but I will be, you know, I know some people are afraid to talk about this, but if you are the head of ATIP, okay, and if you are any UFO guru, like Elizondo, right? If you're at the top, you have a New York Times bestseller. Yeah. By the way, you have to sell an incredible amount of books to make that list. So, you know, let's consider this guy what he is, you know, up there with Greer far as like a following goes.
Yeah.
He ran a government program, allegedly, you know, because ATIP was a moniker, right? It was a moniker, and it was a unclassified way of talking about OSAP, right?
Yeah.
Without spilling the complete beans, because they wanted to get special access program status. OSAP got the $20 million. ATIP was probably more like an unfunded hobby desk, and that's okay. I don't know why we can't admit it, right? Because that would admit the New York Times article was wrong. And, you know, the UFO community has a hard time being wrong. And it's like, we need to be okay with being wrong.
That's right.
But if you are a UFO guru, right? And I use that word like sparingly.
Yeah, air quotes guru.
If you are Elizondo and you are sharing pictures of craft, but then hiding behind the guise of, well, I didn't vet it. I mean, that's like coming into to the teacher and saying, hey, here's my homework, but I copied it off of him. So therefore, I'm not really responsible for it. So if it's bad, just so you know, that wasn't me. What are you fucking talking about, dude?
It's literally a research report with zero bibliography.
And he's standing up in front of serious people.
Yeah.
Serious people
who
now are stuck in between this, because the UFO community is eating him alive right now. But there are the defenders.
Yeah. I'll defend him, but it's one of those, like, we did a whole episode whenever that picture dropped with Mike Turber from 5x5 News, our intelligence guy and security specialist. And it was one of those like, hey, Mike, at what point do you stop vetting information from your vetted source? And I was like, don't get me wrong. Like, I trust you, Mike Turber, and I'll typically take whatever you give me in a knee-jerk fashion. But I'm definitely going to follow it up with looking for more things.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to follow, because it took the guy from Black Vault, like, it took Greenwald from Black Vault, like, 5 minutes to...
One
search.
1 minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
I swear. And you know, what really baffles me is that it's almost... And you know, if I'm the only one asking this, then call me crazy. I don't care. You know, half the people think I'm crazy talking about UFOs in the first place. So whatever. If you know, call it like I say it. But
Kang is way more important.
You gotta ask yourself, how can he get it so blatantly wrong when he knows that it is going to be analyzed? It is going to be diving into. You are going to get scrutinized. People are going to grab this, and they are going to, I mean, the internet community, the internet itself has a way of dissecting and investigating. And it's like the chandelier picture, now this, and it's a couple other things. And you got to ask, how is a guy this credible? How is a guy this smart making these mistakes? Unless he's meant to.
Exactly. And that's what I keep bringing up is unless it's the fact, because I kind of feel the same way about Dr. Greer is I love his work.
Well, did you hear the stuff lately?
Oh, my God, about man. I had Kathleen Marden on and Earl Grey.
She's amazing. I love her.
I had them on back to back to respond to his allegations that her aunt and uncle's case was a case of my lab. Was not an actual abduction. It was a case of the Air Force abducting them and implanting the memory.
Like, and listen.
And like, I was like, Kathleen, would you like an opportunity to respond to this publicly?
She probably just called him an idiot.
Oh, no. She was very complimentary of his work. She was like, I think, and the same thing I said, same thing Earl said. I think he has been fed misinformation by people he trusts over the years. In an effort to create rifts in the community.
All right. So did you see the Danny Jones stuff?
I saw some of it. Yeah.
The recent episode of Danny Jones. And listen, I'll send it to you. I'll send you the clip, but you might want to play it here, like here, if you can, because, bro, there is a paper trail that Dr. Greer might not be a legitimate. Now, I don't know how true this part is, but because he really did work at that hospital, but there's some evidence to suggest that not only is he embellishing about his rank and his many years doing trauma surgery, but there's a paper trail linking him to Mossad. And I don't like to say that because, I feel like Israel and, you know, that intelligence community are getting they're getting battered lately. Everything's getting blamed on them. So I'm not trying to sound like that, but there's actual evidence to suggest that Dr. Greer, I'll send it to you. It's going to blow your mind.
He has, and he's never produced anything of actual worth. There you go. There's a good one.
Here it is. Here it is.
Appreciate I'm that. Quick, buddy.
Maybe may not be something you want to put.
Emily and Stephen Greer, Haifa, Israel. Emily Kramer.
Thank
and
you.
Stephen Greer were married.
Nope.
IE World Center. The bride is the daughter of Miss Douglas Kramer of Palm Beach, Florida, and the late Dr. Kramler. She graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and received a master's degree
shout
in
out
occupational
to Danny
therapy
Jones.
From Boston
Great
University.
Episode.
She was employed by the Peace Corps in Barbados. The bridegroom is the son of Mr. and Mrs. James Greer of 1201 Princeton Avenue. He attended the Appalachian State University and is employed in the Information Processing Department at Bahi World Center. After a trip through Israel, the couple will live in Haifa and work at the Baha'i World Center.
Yep. That's the original marriage notice. Baha'i was regarded as an intelligence gathering operation for Mossad.
Look at Daddy. You see him process it?
Yeah.
And Stephen Greer worked for these people.
And he worked for them. He started with those people. Then he got
this is before he was an emergency room doctor.
You know, I've done a lot of research on
Wow. And that's just it. You know, even things like this, I would say whistleblower status, you know, and that's just it. It's one of those. I work in the world of corporate AV. And the example that I give regularly was I used to be traveled to a show in D.C. every year. That was at INSA. It was an alphabet agency that oversees all the other alphabet agencies. We had 4-star generals, admirals, all kinds of things up on stage, lunches sponsored by Lockheed Martin, stuff like that. I was traveled as the graphics operator. That's the guy that you normally like bring your PowerPoint up to and go, here's my presentation, bring it up on screen. We didn't have presentations anymore because of Edward Snowden. So it was one of those like, wow, for like 5 years, I was traveled in for this show for a position that did nothing.
Nothing.
Because all of that stuff is compartmentalized. And because of whistleblowing, Edward Snowden now like lives in Russia. It's the only place that'll house him.
And I want to make something like super, super clear here. Dr. Gregory Rogers, NASA chief of medicine.
Yep.
Chief flight surgeon, right? This guy, he did not go to DOBSER, which is the DOD pre-publication office, like many other quote unquote whistleblowers. Yep. And we need to stop using that term. Matthew Brown, the Immaculate Constellation. I believe he even went to DOBSER for the most part, but these people are going to DOD pre-publication and saying what that is not a whistleblower.
Yeah.
Let's make it very clear. Yeah. A whistleblower, whether you like him or not, is Edward Snowden. It is people like Dr. Gregory Rogers who are not getting approval by the DOD to become willingly or unwittingly a controlled disclosure agent, if you will,
yeah,
like the others. And I hate to say that.
It's sad, but it is true. And I mean, I will say that because I'm very good friends with Dr. John Hall, who writes a lot of books on targeted individuals and targeting technologies, things like that. He goes to DOBSER before, because otherwise, like, he'll literally lose his medical license, man. Like, he's still a practicing doctor. So he has to go to them to make sure that, like, he can talk about this technology without losing his medical license, that kind of stuff. And it's an actual place. And it is one of those, like, it's a gatekeeping organization. That's what it's there for, to keep the technologies and the programs under wraps.
Because if you touch on something, if you touch on something that they do not want out there, it's like the old Stanley Meyer story, right? When we want to go back to the 1950s and talk about the G engines and T Townsend Brown, and what later was T Townsend Brown's work. The G engines were right around the corner, and then all of a sudden, nothing. They were saying, like, the top scientists in those areas were saying, we are this close to breaking gravity. And by 1955, and this is something Greer does talk about, that I'm like, okay, yes, I do believe that to be the truth as well, that the technology was seized by what became the patent office, right? And that whole scheme, the patent office is just a front for basically controlling technology and controlling technological advancement. Like, there have been many breakthroughs that have been put on the shelf because it would jeopardize income for the government and the complex that they have built. So we know that that's what's happening. And if you aren't, if you can't see that, then take a closer look, because there have been multiple patents that have been seized.
Yeah.
Technologies. So, I would say that, and if we look at these things and we start, like, zooming out, right? Clearly the pressure is mounting, right? The pressure is mounting. People want answers to these questions. Congress, whether you like them or not, they're biting at the chomp as best they can. There's some of them that are bought, some of them that you might not think are bought that are bought. But for the most part, there is good intent around this topic and bipartisan effort.
Yeah.
So, it's hard to say. Like, it's hard to be like, well, should we trust these people that basically lied to us for 80 plus years?
Yeah.
And that's what we're up against right now.
Well, and with all the hearings and everything else, because my father's a boomer. He's an older guy, He's like, oh, you're talking about these little green men. What the hell are you talking about? I'm like, hey, it's not good, because I say it on the show regularly. You are not going to see a pile of wreckage under a tarp brought out onto the floor of Congress and a Houdini aha moment. That's not going to happen. Okay. But what you're going to see eventually through things like the Grush testimony and stuff like that, where it's like, hey, my job was to follow the money. And when I followed it, eventually a door was slammed in my face. I was like, are you okay? Let's say that you owned a McDonald's for the last 80 years. And you found out that your manager has been slowly leaking money for the last 50 into his own pocket. You're good with that? That's what we're finding out, is that there are these dark programs. There are these things that billions of dollars of money are going to, and we, the people, do not know about them. And eventually, I think we will end up with not the pile of wreckage, but we'll end up with an Oliver North style fall guy who belongs to an alphabet agency or contractor thereof and says, yes, I'm here. We've been doing this. This is what we have, stuff like that. But you're not going to see, like, and all of that comes through legal means. Without the good legal means of people like the Disclosure Project and stuff like that, who've been working for years, Steve Bassett, those kind of folks who've been working on the legal pathways in the background, that's where it's going to come from, because that's what we strong arm them with,
And I've seen Steve's work up front, because, when I went to the UFO, I got invited by Tim Burchett down to the hearing that they held in November. Yeah. And I got to see Bassett work really closely, because I had a meeting with Nancy Mace that night, and I conceded my time because I was going to interview her, just about the hearing. And I conceded my time so that Bob Salas could brief her on his scenario from 1967, the Malmstrom case. And Bassett came in with us and, you know, provided documentation and provided all these, you know, a lot more that I had. So, you know, he had files and you know, basically briefings. And I mean, the guy's a, and I'm introducing him at Contact in the Desert, actually.
Nice. Nice. Awesome.
It's going to be really fun. It's going to, sorry, there's okay, an brother. Idiot that's you're blowing good, good. Leaves right next door.
I have amazing technologies that'll get rid of that. So don't worry.
He doesn't. Well, the thing is, and I wouldn't be like, you know, he's blowing leaves, but he does it every day. I'm not joking. Every day he's blowing. I'm like, what are you blowing?
We all have our nervous tics, Tyler.
The yard is clean, dude.
But in sincerity, it's one of those, like, there are good people like the doctor out there who are putting their career on the line to come forward with this information. There are some good whistleblowers out there that are doing some great work, that are really exposing a lot of things that I think will, yes, eventually expose the underbelly of these things. Because, yeah, it's one of those, like, I'm involved in the remote viewing community. And people regularly say, like, oh, you know, it was the funding was canceled because it wasn't found to work. And it's like, oh, no. The funding was canceled. And what happens, as with most programs and technologies, once they are found to work and do well, they disavow them and they give them to their contractors. Because then they can say, we absolutely do not use remote viewing. We use human gathered intelligence, things like that, from our contractors, all that kind of stuff. Their contractors are using remote viewers as part of their intelligence gathering, but then they get to say that they aren't, you know.
Absolutely. And it's plausible deniability.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with all these technologies, because yes, they have been recovered. They have been put into the hands of contractors. Billions, capital B billions, have been put into reverse engineering them and applying them. Eventually, the only way you make that money back is putting it on a shelf, Tyler.
Yeah.
Eventually. And or monetizing or militarizing it. One of the three.
Right. Let's look at it as, I mean, Edison, you had Edison, and you had Tesla, right? Now, Edison's was the inferior product. However, you could tap it.
Yeah.
You could tap it and you could put a meter on it. And JP Morgan Chase would only invest, or, you know, it was set up.
Yeah.
It was a total setup. And went with the inferior option because he wouldn't be able to make money off of what Tesla was working on, because you couldn't, that was free energy.
Yeah. Tesla didn't want to make money off of it. He didn't want to make money. He's just like, it's there though. Why would you go through all that process when you can just gather it and everybody gets it?
Look, that can't be how it is. Yeah, and now we're looking down the same barrel of the gun, the same barrel, just, you know, a different caliber bullet with oil and, you know, petroleum and these natural gases, when they're clearly the inferior product towards gravity, or, you know, anti-gravity craft. But you can't put a meter. You can't sell oil. You know, you can't sell the, I mean, whatever the anti-propulsion gravity, whatever it is. You'll never be able to have a constant revenue stream with that. And it's very clear that that's what's happening. And you know, guys like Dr. Gregory Rogers can attest to the fact that there are some sort of reverse engineering program, because, I mean, what he saw and what I think is one of the biggest details that's being missed is that this had a U.S. Air Force emblem on it.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it had the test markings on it, because if you've ever seen a test craft, there's usually these weird black rectangles on them. And I don't know what he explained what they did or what they're for. I think it's for, like, radar or, you know, when they're filming it to be able to track it. But those were there. It had all the features of a test craft, but it was a flying saucer. And it really, I know he won't say it, but for people who want to visualize it, picture this, what the sports model and what Bob Lazar talks about. It's very similar to that and to what I saw, the flying saucer, the classic one.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so,
yeah, especially having those markings on it. Those markings are all for like, so that you can break down the speed on high speed cameras and stuff like that. Those are all tracking markers for that kind of stuff so that you can get elapsed distance and speed and that kind
of thing. That's right. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know,
like on Mythbusters.
I used to love that show.
I love that show.
I really did. But, you know, I don't want to spoil. I don't really want to spoil his testimony for anyone. So I won't get into the whole thing. But I was approached pretty early on. You know, if you want to know the story, I was approached pretty early on in this process. I think Mindy Taubfest, who kind of revived the Bureau in its current form, she saw something in me.
Absolutely, that, she does.
Yeah, that others, you know, have maybe overlooked, people like Earl, you know, people like Mindy. They see something there, and I was approached pretty early on. And it was funny because, you know, I was going to be there at the same time Josh Boswell was there, but I was unable to do that. So Josh had the kind of the scoop, if you will. And, you know, I essentially said, let's let the bigger outlet take lead on it because that will get it spread out farther.
Sure.
And the reach will be bigger if the Daily Mail puts it out than if I put it out. And then, you know, what we'll do is we'll come in after and say, you know, here's our exclusive interview with that same person. And it worked really well. Over millions of impressions, really, really high click-through rate.
Yeah.
And I know people don't really understand that, but we had a lot of engagement with it over all the different platforms. So, and I was reached out to by a member of Congress to learn more.
Great.
And so I can't talk too much on that aspect of it, but Dr. Rogers was shown a video, closed caption television. I don't want to get into too much of the specifics, but...
No, go watch the video. You want specifics, folks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, what he saw is pretty amazing. But, you know, he's the chief... What I really want to stress is he's the chief of medicine for NASA. Right? Yeah. He oversees over 180 astronauts for the years he's there. They knew him much better than he knew them. When you're overseeing 180 plus people, you know, and doing routinely checkups, you know, you remember them, but you know, it's that doctor relationship. Everybody, if you've ever been in the military and you've had that relationship, with anybody in the military, you know, it's a lot of single serving encounters. Maybe that's not the right word for it, but there's a lot of gear turning in the military and NASA and those kind of environments. So that being said, one of the privates, or I think it was a private, forgive me if I'm miss saying that, but
it's okay.
someone pulled him into the office and showed him something that he probably shouldn't have seen. He definitely shouldn't have seen.
Yeah.
But, and I don't want to go into like the specifics of why, because I think that's a really fascinating part of it, is that he was never supposed to see this. And the fact that he did, you know, obviously, you know, you want to say right place, right time. I look at it more like divine intervention to some degree, because, you know, now... He's been waiting 33 years to tell this story. And there's a big, big detail, like I said, with that U.S. Air Force emblem.
Yeah.
Because for many years, the UFO community is like, well, you know, there's no Russian flag on the UFO. There's no, like, you know, we see these things and they have no markings of any country. Well, now we have one that we know had a marking of a country, and it was the U.S. Air Force. And that's not to say every UFO is man-made. That's not true. But the technology clearly came from somewhere else. And the person that showed him the video, when Dr. Rogers asked, where did we get this? He just pointed up.
Wow.
That's it.
Wow. Incredible. And what an incredible story, not only your own personal story and journey to how you got to this point with media, how you came to this point of involvement in the UFO UAP community, Tyler, but also...
Yeah, sorry, I definitely talk a lot. I apologize.
It's okay. No, that's what it's about, man. That's what we're here for. It's all good. All good.
I love this, though.
Yeah, oh, no, exactly. Same here. And it's one of those, like, the idea of being able to even be a part of the bringing forth of a whistleblower in that kind of way, the idea of being that's able amazing. To help bring the truth to light in that kind of way is fantastic. And what an incredible opportunity for you, and total disclosure, what an incredible bomb of a drop, once again, coming out of the gate for the International UFO Bureau. And the bravery of Dr. Gregory Rogers.
This is just the beginning.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Just
man,
the beginning.
Thank you so much for the time tonight. It's been fantastic. It's been amazingly awesome. Great spending some time with you outside of a Zoom meeting for other things.
You know, maybe next time, next time we do something, we can kind of, you know, now that we've got the formalities out of the way, if you will, next time we could, you know, I'd love to dive deep into, like,
oh yeah,
you know, certain topics or maybe even certain cases, if like that's something that you'd be
absolutely
interested in.
No, I'm all about that. I love having other hosts on, and especially tackling issues in the community. That is a big one for me that I don't think a lot of shows really pay attention to, is how do we curate the community? How do we support each other? How do we support experiencers and whistleblowers? And keep the truth, capital T, out there, you know?
And here's the thing, you know, one of the things about UFO community and that I was going to say earlier, thank you. If there's one message that maybe I can leave people with, aside from going, you know, checking out the UFO Bureau, checking out Total Disclosure, I'll also be at Contact in the Desert. I'm introducing a lot of great people, including Chris Bledsoe. I'll be introducing.
Nice.
So, you know, that's a huge one for me. I can't wait. But definitely, you know, report your sightings at the International UFO Bureau. I think it's Bureau, the next big thing in, you know, investigation, data analysis, as well as, you know, just having a place in a community. I think it's going to be what MUFON was supposed to be. And, you know, I know people don't like to talk bad about MUFON. MUFON's a great organization, but
absolutely.
I think there's a lot more tools that could be used. And I think the Bureau is more inclined to be able to use those.
Yeah.
So if we stop giving credibility, if we stop giving people the benefit of the doubt who have voice or resumes like Dr. Gregory Rogers, if we don't at least hear those types of people out, then what are we doing?
That's right.
What if we become?
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's even the tagline of this show on the way out every time is, you know, thank you for your time. Thank you for your open hearts, your open minds. That's what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. We don't move forward. Without that, without the understanding of, hey, you ask somebody what they think or believe, you don't have to try to change their paradigm after hearing it.
That's the thing,
you
right?
could just accept what they believe prima facie because it's what they believe. You know,
right.
It doesn't have to be an argument. You don't have to be
right.
Because frequently we end up being wrong far down the road. You know,
and it's okay to be wrong.
It is.
It really, it's, you know what? We're dealing with the most complex phenomena.
That's right.
If anyone's telling you they got the secret sauce and a PayPal link, turn the other way and run. Right.
Yeah.
Because no one knows what's going on. Not really. And, you know, we need to be humble and open.
Absolutely.
To disagreement, because disagreement breeds advancement.
That's right. That's right. And you know, that is the whole point of science. You know, there is a ton of science that is laying on the floor because that's what a red team's supposed to do. You're supposed to poke holes in it till the bubble don't float anymore.
Make as many mistakes so that when it does succeed,
you know
you're
it
not
did.
Gonna fail.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
So,
Tyler.
No, this was amazing, man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you for your time.
Great
once
production.
Again. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, checking out everything from Total Disclosure over at YouTube, as well as their website, totaldisclosure.org. Make sure to stop on by the IFOUB website. InternationalUFOBureau.com is where you can find them. That is where you can join as well. They will have their reporting function up oh so soon. So yeah, internationalufobureau.com/join is where you can go to join there. Stay tuned through this quick commercial break, everybody. We will be right back with our good friend and researcher Kathleen Ball. We will be discussing the world of Knights Templar, and specifically Templar Cave in Brazil, how she came to find it, and the research that it has led her down since. We will be right back after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for holding on through that quick commercial break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a CBD user like I am, True Hemp Science is your source for amazing CBD products with a full spectrum of CBD benefits, including terpene profiles. Stop on by True Hemp Science today. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to visit. Christopher Lynch here in Austin, Texas, makes his product using a spigyric process where every part of the plant is used, reused, everything from stems, seeds, buds, leaves, roots, every part of the plant is used, reused, combusted, and reused until nothing remains, providing a full-spectrum CBD product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by True Hemp Science today. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Kathleen Ball. She is the creator of the Brazilian Templar Mystery, and she currently has episode 2 of the Brazilian Templar Mystery coming out. This is an amazing docuseries about the Knights Templar visiting Brazil and a cave that she found during her course of research, all kinds of things. The first episode in the series came out, I guess, a couple years ago. And it's an amazing story, Kathleen, even the way that you came to find this cave. Welcome back to the show. It's been a long time since we've had you on. But
Chris, it's great to be back. Great to be back, and I've been busy.
Yeah, yeah.
As usual, I'm boots on the ground. You know, I've been out there doing research, and I went to Portugal twice last year, and London and France, and backtracking clues. We are in the next episode, episode 2 that's coming out, which I'm really excited about in June 22nd. It's going to show at the Film Festival Theater in Sedona, Arizona. So anyone who's in the area or wants to fly in for that event, it will premiere at that theater. And we're going to be focusing in this film. What we focused on was the interior of the cave. We're doing some, you know, a lot of close-ups of the symbolism in the cave, and also what the cave actually is. We had a couple of uses. We're going to talk about that. I'm not going to spoil it for anybody, but what we discovered the cave actually was used for, and how those symbols relate to other symbols throughout Europe in Templar locations that date all the way back to 1040, from 1040 to 1090, in a very small town called Atugua in Portugal, which is adjacent to what is now Peniche, which is a coastal town. Mm. During that time frame, it was actually an island separated from the mainland, but Peniche is now, you know, part of the mainland. But we also suspect, we believe that Peniche was the port that they were leaving from to go to Brazil. We have pretty good evidence that we're building a case for that right now. We found two commanderies. We found that the history of Peniche includes every single admiral that in the Portuguese Navy has lived in Peniche, and from the century all the way up to the 15th and 16th century. So we have good reason to suspect that Peniche or the Azores Islands were where they launched their ships to go back and forth to Portugal. And now I have become convinced they were not only did they go once and establish, they were going back and forth between Brazil and very probably Peru as well, and bringing back gold and silver from both of these countries. And this is why the king in Portugal, King Dennis, during the time of the suppression of the order in 1307 to 1312, was the only monarch in all of Europe that had any money. You know, the rest of them had spent all the money on the Crusades.
Yeah.
And they were broke. One of the motivators for King Philip the Fair to suppress the order and refill his coffers. So, we know England was broke. We know that all of the countries were relatively broke after these Crusades were over in 1290. So anyway, but King Dennis was not. And we believe that, you know, that the kings in Portugal were privy to and kept this as a state secret, where the location was of this port, protected it, and were aligned with the Templars going back and forth in travel. And I think they were aligned with all of the Templar travels. I think the kings of Portugal were well informed.
Well, and, the fact that the Templars had an amazing navy and were amazing seafarers themselves is something is lost on a lot of their history. You don't really hear about it a whole lot, but what was their connection to having a naval background? Because once again, it would take a lot, and even an armada, to get across the ocean to places like Peru, Brazil, things like that. That is not like a simple one ship trip to make that happen.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. So, we're pretty sure at this point that they had obtained the Phoenician boat building records and, shipbuilding records, and also maps that from the Holy Land and also from Constantinople. What many people don't know, and Timothy Hogan is also talking about this, he's the Grand Master for the Knights Templar here, in the United States, all over, actually, the Gnostic Order. And he's also talking about the fact that the Templars originated long before 1118, which is the official date that they became stamped by the Catholic Church, Templar, right? And that they had actually, I found evidence of the Templars in Greece. I found evidence of the Templars in Turkey. And Timothy corroborated with me on that and said, yes, in fact, that they had been in Greece first, probably as early as somewhere between 1040 and 1060. We don't know exact dates on that, but there is evidence there that they were there. Also, then they went into Constantinople. They were definitely present there between 1090 and the turn of the century. So we know that they were searching out the esoteric, the mystery schools, and all the esoteric knowledge and wisdom that they could get their hands on. So between, you know, and then later, of course, after 1096, then we know that they were present in the Holy Land, and that they were given the, you know, the area of the stables above the Temple Mount, where the remains of the Temple Mount were.
Yeah.
And that they were excavating for 9 years. We know this, that the original Knights, the core of the Knights Templar members, were excavating underneath the Temple Mount, which had been the location of the Temple Mount. And that they were... they eventually brought this stuff back into Europe, and then we believe that it was probably taken into Portugal for safekeeping until the Inquisition came in the 1500s. They finally got their way into Portugal, which they had been trying to do for centuries, and dismantled everything. I mean, it was a reign of terror in Portugal at that time when they did that.
Mm.
And then... at that point, you know, we believe that this cash treasure was transferred into Scotland and eventually came over to the United States. It's not in Oak Island. I want to make sure that everybody understands that. It's not in Oak Island. I personally don't believe there's anything in Oak Island anymore. I think it was already gone long ago to fight the civil, you know, the war of independence. Honestly, that's what I believe.
Yeah.
Happened. But, you know, the manuscripts and the scrolls and those things are just as important for Templar historians and for the world, because it's the truth is finally coming. It's finally being serviced. We're finally seeing facts, you know, that had been suppressed for hundreds of years, for between 700 and 800 years now. This information has been suppressed. And I also, of course, I uncovered a strategic, there is no other way to, you know, to describe it, agenda by the Catholic Church sending out their Jesuit priests to murder Templars and Templar families and anyone who was even related to the Templars all through South America and most parts of the world. They were going out and they were murdering these families. I have, you know, I've seen books and documentation of this. So, you know, they were responsible for the suppression of volumes and volumes and volumes of records and everything that we would have loved to have gotten our hands on, you know, in terms of Templar history and, you know, what they were doing. And what wasn't destroyed, the Templars themselves and Templar families hid, or they destroyed themselves, you know. Because they didn't want to be identified, you know, because they didn't want their family members murdered and they didn't want to die themselves, you know. So
yeah.
What's happening in Portugal, which is really interesting, and also in some other countries, is some of this history, now that it's relatively safer, is starting to surface. And I've been privy to some in Portugal, some family records that talk about their ancestors having been Templars and their travels. So we're starting to get some really, really, interesting information is starting to surface. And I'm excited. I'm really excited about that. I'm going to be, you know, taking my third trip to Portugal. It's coming up this summer. And I'm going to combine it with my English. I'll be doing a lecture in England, by the way, at the Atlantis bookstore.
Awesome.
In August, and I'm going to combine my Portugal trip with that, And I have another area that I'm going to be researching, and also some more of these family records, which I'm very excited about. So,
well, that is great, because I mean, you know, number one, the records of families, things like that. Europe had fantastic record keeping when it came to these things. America is fascinating. Like, even recently, my uncle did some family research into our family and started going to a few heritage sites and things like that and looking things up. And there was apparently somebody who just like popped up out of nowhere, just like bling. And it's like, wow, somebody decided to reinvent themselves whenever they came over. You know, like there's just like nothing. It's just like a dead stop, you know.
Yeah.
But when you get over to Europe, when you get over to England, things like that, these records are immaculately kept.
Yes.
Because at that point, literal familial lines and their connections to crown and kingdom and things like that counted on this stuff. So
right.
it was immensely important to keep proper records. And that was probably more than any other order.
One of the reasons for that is in my book, my new book that I'm writing now, The mm-hmm. Templar Agenda. The Templars were, you know, they had infiltrated and gotten themselves close to every single monarchy
exactly.
in Europe. And they were involved as bankers, as counselors, as mediators. They counseled the monarchs in
yep.
War, in, you know, land disputes, just you name it. They were highly respected, and they were involved in everything. So of course we're going to find records
yeah.
in these countries about the Templars. But there's twofold reason for this. What they had created in Portugal, what I've come to discover, what they created in Portugal was a sovereign nation of harmony. They had Christians, they had Catholics, they had Jews, they had Islam, they had Druids, they had Cathars. They rescued the Cathars from France during that whole, you
yep.
know, that whole heretical war that the church, you know, when they were arresting and murdering the Cathars,
yeah.
the Templars, but they were related. They had family relations with these people, with the Cathars. So they had all of these religious, economic, cultural backgrounds of all these people, of all these different backgrounds, all living in Portugal in harmony and functioning perfectly, just fine. I mean, everything
yeah.
was going well. And this is one of the reasons why the Catholic Church wanted so bad to get into Portugal and break through their defenses so they could destroy that. But the Templars were it must have been incredibly difficult the way they balanced their relationship with the Catholic Church. Because here they
yeah.
are, hired by the Catholic Church to be crusaders, and they did devote a very large, in fact, the majority of their members to the crusaders as soldiers to fight over there
yep.
for the church. But at the same time, right under their nose, they've created this sovereign nation full of heretics, right? And what they were hoping to do was bring about a sort of renaissance of all of these esoteric beliefs and this knowledge that they had discovered. This was their true agenda. And to bring their use the template that they had created in Portugal, use that as a template throughout the world, country by country by country. So this is another reason why they were so close to the monarchs and the nobles in all of these countries, because this was their intention, was to bring about, duplicate what they had created in Portugal
yeah.
in all of these other countries in the world, and to have a world of equality, so that we could move forward with our evolutionary progression as a united world, you know, not this stuff that we're dealing with today with all these wars and we're constantly battling each other.
Mm.
You know, what they envisioned was a world, a sovereign world of equality with, you know, the different religions and the different cultural backgrounds and economic backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. But this is what they wanted to put forward, and this is still the agenda today. So, of the current Templars, you know, this is still their agenda today. So, this is what I'm talking, this is what I'm writing about now in my second book, because I think this is really important, especially given the political atmosphere that we're dealing with, not just here in the United States, but in many other countries in the world right now. I mean, we're dealing with some difficult situations. So I think it's important to remember. And also what many people don't know is that the Templars, when they did go underground in 1307, they had already been involved in Scotland, and they were, you know, working with Robert the Bruce. They were working on the Magna Carta. They had a hand in the Magna Carta, which eventually was used as the foundation for the United States, the independence of the United States of America, and our articles of, you know, independence over here. So, you know, if you want to, if you really want to to look at the base and the foundation for the United States of America, look at the Templars, because they were the ones that inspired what we originally had here in the United States of America, a country that's this big, you know, that is this big, sovereign country with all of these multiple nationalities. This was the primary purpose and the original purpose of the United States of America, where we could embrace people from all walks of life, all backgrounds here in the United States, and live harmoniously.
Yeah.
And that was the original point. So we've, you know, this is what we have had for 200 years. So
hoping
to keep it.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, to echo that back to the control of ruling families, things like that, and the connection of the Knights Templar to those ruling families, once, especially when you're talking about ruling families, specifically in Italy, things like that, the Medicis, the Doges of Venice, that kind of stuff, their reach went far, far and wide, not only in the church, but within the halls outside of that, within the halls of governments, within the halls of things like the Knights Templar, because it was not only a point of honor for any family to have a son or a relative that was a monk or something like that to begin with, or a priest. It was a huge badge of honor for a family, much less to have a son that was a knight or served in the military in that kind of way. If you have a monk knight in your family, or a knight's temp or a knight templar, like that was the ultimate badge of honor as far as a ruling family went. So how did that play out, especially their royal connections, things like that, throughout various families in Europe? How did that play out with their escape and their survival?
Well, they were able to, because, you know, they did come from, the knights themselves took a vow of poverty, but they were connected to very wealthy families and very well-connected families. And so during the time of the suppression, you know, it wasn't difficult to hide family members, and, you know, many of them became stonemasons, as we know, that continued with the building skills that they had. You know, building all the cathedrals in Europe and everything else. I mean, we know that they went into that trade. Many of the Templars did that. We also know from evidence in Brazil that they actually moved to Brazil and that they married into the indigenous cultures there in Brazil, probably also in Peru. I would just give my eye teeth to be able to do DNA testing in certain areas of Brazil and Peru, because I would bet you anything that we have DNA from Templar families from Europe. Now, I know for a fact, I've uncovered, there's a man named Matt McGregor that I'm working with a little bit on history. He has a Templar descendant in the McGregor clan whose name was Duncan McGregor. But what was interesting about Duncan is Duncan was born, or he died, excuse me, he died in 1292, and he had an interesting appellation. He was called Duncan Maceo McGregor. Now, Maceo refers to a body of water, and which is interesting, though, is it's not only a Portuguese appellation and word, but it's also a Brazilian Portuguese, because the Brazilians speak Portuguese too, yes, but it's a little different. But it also, that particular word is used in Brazil. So we have reason to believe that his family members may have been some and the same, you know, one and the same, that had traveled, that had actually traveled to Brazil. Why he would have a Portuguese, and specifically a Brazilian Portuguese middle appellation name that was given to him, is really pretty good evidence that you know, that he had definitely affiliation. I mean, there definitely, yeah, had a good affiliation. So so what we think is that the families were, they were, you know, obviously the Templar families were welcoming, and their Templar, you know, descendant, their children, their cousins, their sisters, their brothers, their fathers, their husbands, etc., back into the fold, and, you know, and shuffling them into society however they could do that, you know. And then again, like I said, we found evidence of them being in India. We found evidence of them being possibly even in Japan. There is some other research that I'm starting that will be part of the next 5 series on the Templars' travel. I'm finding them all over the world, Chris. I mean, there's evidence of Templars all over the world. And we know from a fact from, you know, from Scott Walter and Timothy Hogan's research, that the Templars were also here in the United States of America and North America as early as the 14th century. So,
yeah, yeah, precisely.
So, you know, there's they were travelers. They were seafaring travelers. You know, these commanderies that we discovered in Peniche, what they appear to have been is where they were training the sailors. They were training their nautical crews here at these two commanderies, one at either end of Peniche. And they also had, you know, huge areas where they, like convents, where they were housing these people and preparing them for seafaring trips. So, you know, they had the money. They definitely had the money, you know, up until they were suppressed. But one of the reasons that I think most people don't, they kind of overlook, or it just gets played down, the reason for the suppressions was primarily triggered by the fact that after 1290, after the fall of Acre in the Holy Land, when they came back, the monarchs were broke. So they, you know, they kept trying, especially in England, they kept trying to fund more crusades to try to take the Holy Land back. But it wasn't, the people were tired. They were broke. Because the people, the money was coming from the people who were already poor. You know, I mean, most of these families didn't have a lot of money. And so basically what happened is they outlived their usefulness as crusaders, which was how they were attached to the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Yeah, that was their
primary purpose. And so when that fell, when that fell away, that usefulness fell away, everybody looked at him like, oh, okay, well, so now what's your purpose here? And I think, you know, Jacques de Molay at that point would have been wise to have found other reasons to be, you know, to continue the order. And I don't think he was able to, you know, to change things and shift into something else that made them important and necessary.
Well,
even if they were used, you know, as, like I said, confidants for the monarchs and bankers, et cetera. I mean, they could have done more with that. They could have made themselves vital in other ways. And I think they failed to do that. And so, you know, it really contributed to their victimization at that point.
Yeah.
They became easy targets. Well, and scapegoats.
You become an enemy rapidly, because once again, I mean, their charter was under the Poor Knights of Christ. Even then, they were knights first.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So they were a monastic order of knights. Awesome. But as long as you still got those swords and that armor, you are a threat to the papacy.
Well, absolutely. As it stands.
Like, you're just an absolute threat. You know, so as soon as you are no longer useful in the Crusades and that's no longer happening, it becomes, what do we do to disarm them? What do we do to get rid of the direct threat that we have built? You know,
exactly. Chris, so, exactly. And that's the other part of it. You know, here now, instead of being heroes, they're looked at as threats.
Precisely.
Not only by the church, but also by the monarchs at this point, because who had the power? You know, it was always the military force, you know, whatever leader had the military force behind them.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, there were not a lot of soldiers left after, you know, in the Templars' military order, there was so many that they lost thousands and thousands of their numbers over in the Holy Land. So they were still, like you said, they were still considered a threat at that time. And so, you know, and they had a lot of money too. So it made it very attractive to the monarchs to, you know,
especially,
to come in. We know this has been done over and over in history.
Yeah.
You become a target when you have money in the church, you had the power. Because we had the power of kings that could come in and do whatever they wanted. And they would justify it with whatever propaganda they sent out to the people, and the people swallowed it hook, line, and sinker, like, you know, we're seeing today. We're seeing a very similar replication of that today. So anyway, so, you know, what I saw happen is, from my research, the records indicate that many of the Templars, their descendants later became Masons. They became Rosicrucians. Mm. They became Masons, stonemasons. And they continued to, you know, with their beliefs, many of them did. However, at that time, which you can imagine was a very difficult time, there were also many that were compromised. So,
sure.
This is where we see the basis of the root for the stories that people say, oh, the Masons are terrible people, you know, they're evil and blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, in any organization, you're going to have people that become compromised.
Yep.
It's when they become the majority is when you start having issues, you know, when you start, you know, and you see more are bad than they are good, and that's when you have a problem. I don't think that's the case in the Masons, and I definitely don't believe that's the case within the Templar Order or the Rosicrucians. But I can't deny, and I won't deny, that there are some that have nefarious interests and agendas that, you know, claim to be aligned with these organizations. So, unfortunately, we have that in this world. You got to take the good with the bad.
We do. And there's nothing you can really do about that, you know, and that's just it. That was part of what, I mean, it was that double whammy of not only possibly being more powerful than the Pope, but it showing the fact that you were more powerful than a monarch, you know, that when the monarch was like, kneel, put your knee down before me. And do what I'm telling you to do. Go rouse the Jewish people out of Paris and take all their money, and that'll pay off my debt to you. You know, that'll make us even if you go do this. And they were like, absolutely not. So the double whammy of that, and just the show of power that not only were they above the monarchy, but they were above the church, that they had not only the manpower, but the muscle to be above both, really did kind of set things up in a bad way.
Well, and the church was very jealous of the fact that they were collecting tithes, you know, from their own chapels, from people sure. that attended chapels. You know, they were collecting tithes from their towns that they lived in. Each town, major city, all throughout Europe had Templar commanderies, you know, locations where the Templars, they were teaching the locals animal husbandry, you know, farming, how to build mill wheels, you know, water wheels and mills and all these things. I mean, they had vast, vast lands throughout Europe. Everywhere I go, I've seen evidence of, you know, vast, vast lands. They planted herbs. They were doing alchemy, but they were also very involved in herbology. Mm. You know, there was so much that they were involved in that they were teaching the locals. I mean, they really contributed a tremendous amount. I mean, to Europe, you know, as a continent, and in England as well, you know, in the island.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they've ever been given the credit for that, for just how much they actually contributed in so many other ways besides being crusaders and, you know, bankers, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we see the evidence of that in Portugal. Portugal is an extremely productive country. You know, I love Portugal. I almost moved there. You know, if my husband hadn't been diagnosed with dementia, I really was going to move there. I was planning it. I'm learning Portuguese, by the way. I'm in my fourth, going into my fifth month now.
Awesome.
Of learning the Portuguese language. So it's, you know, it's something that I hope someday that I will be able to at least have a home over there and be able to travel freely back and forth because I really love Portuguese culture and, you know, what the Templars, this all came out of what the Templars created and initiated in that country. And it's phenomenal. You know?
Well,
but another thing I wanted to mention is when I went into France, I went back into France. I've been to France numerous times, but I did go to compare symbols that I had found in the cave with the ones I found in Portugal and also that I found in Dome. I returned to Dome and I went to Chinon as well, which were two locations where they housed the Templars during the suppression from 1307 to 1312 approximately. And I found more symbols and I found more churches. I found a small 12th century church in a little town, Septmes, in France. And I also found this was just blew me away. Leonardo da Vinci has been someone, he's been a mentor for me. He's dead, you know, but I have studied him and researched everything. That's how I taught myself how to draw and how to sculpt was with his notes that he left. Well, I found out when I went to Amboise, France this last time that da Vinci lived in his chateau off, which was separate from the castle. With King Francis I, he lived less a stone's throw from the St. John the Baptist Templar Church that was active during the time that he lived.
Wow.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. So there's every reason to believe that he was very affiliated. He was definitely affiliated. He could walk there on a morning walk.
Yeah.
Within a few minutes and be at this chapel, a St. John chapel here in Amboise, France. So,
wow.
You know, Leonardo da Vinci was integral with the Renaissance in Europe, right?
Yep.
And so were the Medici family, who King Francis I was married to Catherine de Medici.
Yep.
So here we have the Renaissance, right? And Leonardo da Vinci's affiliation with the Templars.
And the Medicis.
And the Medicis.
Yeah. So.
Okay. So I now have reason to believe that the Templars were actually, you know, the foundation of the Renaissance was derived from Templar information and wisdom that they had gathered all the way back in the 11th century when they were in Istanbul and all over, right? When they were Constantinople and all over. I think that I'm starting to believe now, and I'm doing research on this, that they were actually part and parcel responsible for what came out of the Renaissance. I mean, you certainly see it in Da Vinci and Raphael and Michelangelo and the use of sacred geometry. See it, you know, sacred geometry in the buildings during the Renaissance period. We're seeing this explosion of this esoteric knowledge that's now being introduced and used and spread throughout the people and the whole world.
Yeah.
Right? All of a sudden, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Where did it come from?
Well,
you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It didn't just all of a sudden pop from out of the air into Europe. You know, there had to have been a bridge of some sort. And I believe that stuff was derived from Templars.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we've talked about with Gretchen Cornwall is the knowledge of the color red, specifically in stained glass, that the Templars had. Their connection with King Solomon, with Solomon's mines, all kinds of stuff. The one thing that you need to achieve that specific color red is actually copper nanoparticles. So you would need a massive supply of copper in order to make that happen, in order to consistently be able to make glass for these cathedrals, things like that. You would have to have a massive supply of disposable copper to make that happen.
All of these glass making skills and all this stuff. But we're talking, you know, had to come from Phoenician records. And, you know, they had to have been privy to information that went hundreds of years, thousands of years prior to their existence. They had to get it from somewhere because it certainly wasn't in the European continent. Yeah. This information was not available. Other than, you know, of course, we had the Moors in Spain. They still had some of this ancient knowledge and of course, Islam, too, because we had, you know, the whole Islam Sufi order from that sect of religious beliefs. We had that, of course, in Spain and whatnot. But I think most of this stuff was coming out of Constantinople and the Holy Land, brought into Europe by the Templars.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And from their travels over there.
Yeah, we could actually say that the Templars were at least partially responsible, and I think they were much more than just partially responsible for the bringing about of the Renaissance, you know, again, which the Catholic Church tried to suppress, you know, they suppressed this information.
Yeah. So. Yeah, precisely.
And then, you know, this was a very important thing. I don't think I mentioned this on the last show with you, but while I was in Portugal, when I was doing research in this one church in Atuguia, just outside of Peniche that I mentioned earlier, you know, I found a whole narrative of what appears to be the Holy, I'm not talking about the Holy Family in terms of Mother Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. I'm talking about Jesus and Mary Magdalene and their children.
Oh, wow.
There's a narrative on the outside of this church that indicates this family has been preserved, at least the story of this family had been preserved on the outside of this church. And on the inside of the church are numerous, at least 12 to 15 symbols, graffiti left by the Templars. They built this church between 1040 and 1090. And these are identical to the ones that I have in my cave. And also what I've come to find out through Timothy Hogan, that these are initiation. They indicated levels of initiation.
Oh, wow.
While I'm filming, all set up, had permission from the Office of Patrimony from the country of Portugal, 2 weeks in advance of my coming to this church to photograph and film, all of a sudden in waltzes this man, and he comes up to me and he says, you have to stop filming. You can't film inside this church. And I said, on whose authority? And he said, well, I'm friends. I'm affiliated with the people involved, you know, that it's the clergy. And he starts rattling off a bunch of baloney. And I knew it was baloney. Anyway, so I said, I think you and I need to have a talk outside. And he just kind of looked at me and I said, no, I'm serious. We need to have a discussion. So we walked outside and I said, who are you and who do you think you are that you can come in and tell me? I already have permission from the Office of Patrimony.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm above that office. It's one of the things he said to me. And he said, you cannot film in him. And so I said, look, I want you, I gave him my card and I said, is there any chance, I said, that you can get special permission? I said, because I've already been given permission to film it.
Yeah.
And I said, all I want is just to film this one panel that's behind the altar that shows these crosses that are the same that are in my cave. And he says, oh, you don't want that. He said, those are nothing. Those are just sailors that came in that wanted blessings from the church. And I said, well, then you explain to me what they're doing in my cave in Brazil, 3,000 kilometers away from any ocean. And he couldn't. He had no, nothing. Well, I don't know any. Anyway, so he took my card, and I never heard from him, which I didn't expect to. I was expecting him to give me a card, which he did not do. But I did a background search on him. We found out that he was Opus Dei.
Uh-oh. Interesting.
Right. Great. Yep. Opus Dei. So just for people who don't know, Opus Dei is alive and well, and they all are also several of the authors of Project 2025. Yep. FYI. So I found this very interesting that, you know, that we have people, and I'm not the only researcher that's being halted, whatever you want to call it, suppressed from conducting their research in these countries. There's another very well-known researcher who has just been told that he could not hold his lecture at Armoral Castle in just outside of Tomar, that he had to find another location by the same people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is something that we're dealing with. I mean, this is right straight out of the Da Vinci Code, for Christ's sake, Chris. This is like, seriously, you know? I mean, and just to add, it didn't stop me from getting the photos. I got them anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got them and I have them, and I'm going to be putting them out in this book that I'm writing right now. So I was able to get them anyway. But the fact that our free will and our, you know, our ability to free speech, free will, all these things are in question at this time in history. And it's all over the world this is happening. You know, this is happening all over the world.
Yeah.
It's something that, you know, I think we need to be really concerned about. And, you know, when it affects researchers like myself, I mean, this is something I take very seriously because,
well, sure.
You know, I have been a representative of truth. I have been a researcher and truth seeker all my life, you know, and to be able to be told flat out that I can't share this research, I can't share truth with the world. I mean, that's something that I find very upsetting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I could see that, and even trying to access documents, things like that, trying to track these things down. Once again, even though documents were meticulously kept in Europe, does not mean that you get easy access to documentation. Doesn't mean that you get easy access to small town information, things like that. You know,
yeah.
So there are a lot of hoops to go through as a researcher when it comes to those things, when it comes to tracking stuff down.
Right. It takes months, you know, and I have a couple fellow researchers that I work with in Portugal that are boots on the ground over there, forming my eyes and ears when I'm not there, that contact me and We have numerous Zooms throughout the year together, and we discuss, you know, our research and they have found that I may have missed or that they think that they, you know, might be a good idea that I go see.
Sure.
So, you know, I have this happening, not just in Portugal, but also in other countries. So I'm really, you know, I really value these people, and I really value the fact that I have these connections. They're not easy to develop. I mean, you know, you develop these relationships with these people with, you know, integrity and honesty and openness. And, you know, this is how you develop these relationships. So, it doesn't just happen overnight, you know. I mean, sometimes I just get lucky, like when I discovered the cave. I mean, that was a lucky discovery. That was very, I believe, it was something I think I was supposed to discover. I think it was part of my own personal journey, my own personal grail quest to discover that cave.
I wasn't
looking for it.
No, exactly. And nor was this like an extreme course of study in your life before you found it.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise, like the cave led you down all of this.
Right. I wouldn't even have known what I was looking at, Chris, if I hadn't had that background.
Yeah.
You know, that background and had been to Dome and, you know, if I hadn't been to Dome, I would have never recognized that.
So. Well, and, you know, the funny thing is, Kathleen, I there would still be full respect, but it would be a different amount of respect had you been a Templar researcher and your research led you to the cave. That'd be right. One thing. But the fact that you were on a totally different course, you were on something totally different. You were down there to have an ayahuasca ceremony to help heal yourself physically and happened upon this cave and the story of it. And that led you down this course of research, which has uncovered all of this.
Right.
So I find that much more remarkable. Than you know, somebody who spent the last 20 years of their life doing hard Templar research, and hey, look at that, we came across the cave that we heard about, you know. It's absolutely awesome. And once again, the way that it has catalyzed your life, the way that it has changed your life, I love the way that, yes, quite literally, it is your grail quest. That is the idea of a grail quest, is that never-ending quest for something that changes and catalyzes you in a different way.
It changes and catalyzes me and also, you know, the readers for my book, which, of course, if anybody's interested, it's available on Amazon.com. A Grail Quest is all you have to pull up. And, you know, and the book's been out for 2 years now.
Yep.
And doing pretty well, by the way. But I, you know, outline, I don't just talk about the discovery. I talk about my life, because my life led up to this discovery.
Yeah.
So it's somewhat autobiographical to some degree, you know. And I talk about the trials and tribulations and the struggles and things that helped me build who I am today. You know, why I am who I am today, and the strength that I got out of all those trials and tribulations, and the determination and perseverance, et cetera, which has given me the foundation to be able to go out into these places. And, you know, and I travel alone, you know, I'm usually travel alone. I hire a photographer and sometimes a translator, film crew, whatever I need in the countries where I go. So, you know, that's another thing women don't do, is travel alone.
Yeah.
But now I have a very strong faith and connection with a higher power. And I believe that higher power and that connection is what led me to that cave. But, you know, ultimately, there were just too many synchronicities that took place. And, you know, and I've had other synchronicities, of course, you know, that I met that nun in Marseille while I was, you know, on this trek. Who had been waiting for me for 20 years. She had learned English in college so that when I came, she could speak with me. That was her back word. So these are, you know, very synchronistic experiences that, you know, that are not explainable other than the fact that, you know, there's some reason why I've been chosen or whatever to continue with this Grail quest and continue, you know, discovering and bringing these truths forward to the world. You know, I believe that, you know, this is my personal quest, and and it just gets more exciting and more exciting every day. The further I dig into this, the more I discover and the more I realize just how important it is to continue this research and bring it forward to the world.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, precisely.
You know, I have down days. I have down days like everybody, you know? And I've spoken with you during those times, you know? I mean, sure. I've had down days where I question what I'm doing. I question, you know, everything. Yep. Just like everybody else. But this, again, is also part of a Grail quest. This is all part of a Grail quest.
That's right.
And I believe everyone in this world has a Grail quest. It's just stepping out into the unknown, the unexpected, following a dream, following a commitment, following a passion.
Yeah.
You know, whatever your passion might be. I think what was it? Follow your bliss was what Campbell.
That's right.
Joseph Campbell. Yeah, follow your bliss. And that's really true. That's true. And then, you know, I believe that today I am the person that I always was meant to be. 100%. You know, yeah. You become authentic. You become comfortable in your own skin. You become who you know, you fulfill your potential. Of the way that God created you. And and that's what I believe has happened to me. You know, I have fulfilled that potential. And along the way, I get these special little gifts like discoveries in Templar caves, you know, healings in the Amazon jungle, being adopted by the Hunaquin chief, you know, these kind of things happen, you know, meeting nuns in Marseille and just other things that have taken place throughout this quest that I'm on. And, you know, and it's become a beautiful life, you know, it's become a really beautiful life. And I highly suggest, you know, I am a real supporter of anyone who has the courage to step out into their own real quest, because I believe that this is truly what we were created to do, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a choice of vibration. It is a choice of mission in life. You know, and unfortunately, Kathleen, I think a lot of people can confuse mission with other things, you know, and don't really struggle to find, I guess, that purpose in life, that thing that really is them and drives them, you know, and once you find it, it's a beautiful thing and it's amazing.
Right.
And you things know, just fear... tend to line up at that point.
Well, I think fear is a big factor in that, you know, and the fact that, you know, we've moved so far away from nature that, you know, we don't have anything free anymore. I mean, we don't live off the land anymore. We, you know, I mean, we typically grow up in a family where we're sent to college or we go to college or we don't, we get a job depending on whatever our economic class is.
Yeah.
We fall in love, we get married. Next thing we know, we're stuck in this situation where we have a beautiful family and we're either happy or not with our marriage. We're working in a job that we either, you know, most often don't particularly like. We feel stuck in, you know, and we're questioning everything because we've got this mortgage. We may have debt, we may not, whatever the situation is personally for people. But, people are trapped. They find themselves trapped. They find themselves trapped in, you know, with drugs, with alcohol, with mortgages, with, you know, economic situations. And then they don't know how to break out of that. You know, they don't know how to figure out a way to get back to who they were. You know, my dad, I love this. My dad was a professor, but he also was a haiku poet and he was a master, considered a haiku master on all of North America and in Japan as well. Anyway, he wrote this, my favorite poem, and he said, "Winter morning, I try to remember the dream I had as a child." And that for me encapsulates the way back.
Yep.
The way back to who you were when you were a child, because you had it all then. You had it. You had it all. It was all there. You still have it. You just have to dig down and unbury it.
Yeah.
And bring it to the surface again. And then you have to just follow the path where it leads you. That's what I did.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I did.
Yep.
You know? And that is the path. And I talk about that on my TikTok channel. You know, I talk about all the levels of the Grail Quest, and I outline 10 levels of Grail Quest, you know, the way that you embark and continue on your Grail Quest. And, you know, they're really pretty simple level. I mean, it just involves, you know, you make a decision, you realize that you're really not happy. I mean, it starts with truth.
Yeah.
With just facing truth. And then, you know, and if you've got an addiction of some sort, you've got to deal with that addiction or whatever it is. And once you've taken the monkeys off your back and you can make a decision, a choice of one thing, just one thing to get you off on your quest, it could be, you've always wanted to go to Big Sur and meditate on the beach. Could be that simple. Maybe you've always wanted to go to Yosemite and you wanted to camp out in nature. This is the times when the answers come to you. These are the times when the epiphanies come, is when you open yourself up in nature and you allow yourself to remember who you were. And then, you know, then, oh, wow, okay, well, now I can save for a plane ticket because I always wanted to go to Egypt, or I always wanted to go to Mexico, or I always wanted to go to Alaska. This is how it starts. This is how a Grail Quest starts. And then you continue to build on those experiences. You reprioritize your life, and you make these things priority that you want to do, and you a way to accomplish just a little thing. It can start with interviewing people who are doing what you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it can start with just simple things like that. It can start with volunteering for people, you know, volunteering in agencies that you've always wanted to really work in. It could be the Peace Corps. It could be God knows what. Doesn't matter. It's your individual gem, your precious gift of who you are.
Yeah.
And when you get to realize who that person is, it's the biggest and best gift, because you finally know, and you don't have any question about how much God loves you.
Yeah.
Because if he could love you that much to make you be, you know, to create who you are, and allow you to express who you've become, you know for a fact that nothing can stand in your way.
Yeah.
Inevitably, nothing can stand in your way. It's just like, you know, that Opus Dei guy, he tried to stop me, you know?
Well,
he didn't stop me.
I
still did what I wanted to do.
Yeah, it's the idea that you're supposed to love yourself as much as God loves you.
Absolutely.
You know, and until you do... Yeah. Until you do, it's going to be really hard to find that perfect life mate that you may be looking for, or that job that actively fulfills you instead of just gets you through from 9 to 5 that you slog to every day and slog home from, you know.
Exactly. And I think it comes down to the misery has to outweigh, you know, you have to, okay, the possibility that I could become something else has to outweigh the misery that you're living in.
Yeah, that I could actively be happy.
Say, I just can't do this anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It is a choice that you make every day. It's an active decision that you make every day to be happy. Despite anything, to be happy. Like, hey, I'm self-employed. Absolutely. I do all kinds of things. But I work 60, 70 hours a week to make all that happen. But I'm happy. Yeah. I could be working 60, 70 hours a week for somebody else and not have this show or the time to do this show. barely have, yeah, like people ask me why my son is so well balanced. It's like, because I work from home. When I come home from work after an 8-hour day at work, hour and a half on the road, it's not like, hey, nice to see you, boy, did you get food in your mouth, good night, you know. I actively have time to enjoy and spend with him and do things with him, but it takes a lot of effort to make that happen. And a Grail quest is effort. It doesn't just happen, you know. You have to push the slinky to make the slinky move. That's how the universe works. All kinds of bound up potential inside of the slinky, or the spring that is that slinky. But until you actively move it, it doesn't do anything. So, exactly. And that's the Grail.
What the universe does, though, which is the beautiful thing, is mirror your inspiration and your joy.
That's right.
And match you. And you will start to see all sorts of synchronistic things that take place along your quest.
Yeah.
You know, that, and it's like when I was heading up to this cave, which I didn't even know I was going to be discovering, the woman that I went with, my dear friend Adele, you know, she didn't know how to drive a car with a clutch. Well, I forgot my driver's license, so I couldn't get the car. So we were dependent on her driving skills to get us there. She blew out two clutches on the way. So we had to stop. Otherwise, we would have not ended up in Alto Paraíso at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, okay. So, you know, and then we would have been in some other place. Chances are we would have never been in Alto Paraíso. And, you know, and I was just from driving, when I drive a long ways, the next day I've got to get out and get some exercise. So I walk into town, which leads me to find out about these waterfall places to go to, right? Which inevitably, you know, resulted in us going down to this waterfall. And we come up just at the moment that the owner of the camping posada happens to be there and say, hey, would you girls like to go over next door to the adjacent property and go see these crystals and this crystal vein that runs through this land? I mean, how synchronistic is that, Chris?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it happened to be hot that day when we were going down the trail and we saw the crystal vein. It happened to be extremely hot. Otherwise, he wouldn't have mentioned, well, I know this little cave over here that we can cool off and have some refreshment, right? I mean, if all of those synchronistic events had not taken place, I would have never found the cave.
And I cannot wait for part two to come out. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's always great catching up with you. Always great talking about this vast, once again, realm of research that you have stumbled across and hard earned. Over the last many years since discovering this cave and everything else that you have found. When does you release? Where does it release? Where can people go to keep up with the releases? Where can they go to become part of your tour that's happening? And all that kind of good stuff.
Oh, yes, the tour in Portugal with Hamilton White and myself is in October. It's in the first part of October, and you can go to my website, www.templarsinbrazil.com, and this is we're going to Templar sites, specific places that I have found, some never seen before, not offered on anybody else's tours, that places that I go for my Templar research. I will be taking the people and Hamilton White as well. He's bringing some of his relics, actually be able to see and, you know, touch personally some of these relics from the lost relics of the Knights Templar show. So we're going to be leading this tour. We're going to go all through Portugal into Tomar, and it's priced very reasonable so that it's affordable for people. And again, I'd love to see you, and Hamilton would love to see you. And we're looking forward to this trip, 4th through the 14th of October in 2025. And you can sign up on the website. So just go to events, and it's under, you click on events and you go under the events section, and you can sign up.
Fantastic. Absolutely awesome. Once again, thank you so much as always, Kathleen, for joining us. Thank you as always for sharing your best.
I always love coming on your show.
It's always fun.
I enjoy catching up with you. So.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out all of the amazing research of Kathleen Ball at TemplarsInBrazil.com, everybody, and finding out more about how you can join Kathleen on this amazing journey through Portugal to Templar sites, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find all the books from our guests, binaural beat meditation music. That's where you can find the Knights Templar film as well. All kinds of things right there at CuriousRealm.com/store, as well as your link to the field observation and encounter log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFO, cryptozoology, ancient civilizations, things like that, the field of observation and encounter log is your back pocket data log to write down all of your data as it happens in the field in real time, so that you have the best quality data to shake hands with science come the day that you are ready to do so. Thank you so much for your time tonight, everybody. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.